Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What did the Founding Fathers intend when they enshrined the right to bear arms in the Bill of Rights of the U.S. Constitution, and how should that provision be interpreted in the 21st century? There are an estimated 300 million firearms in this nation of 311 million people, distributed among at least 60 million gun owners. And as my guest today has learned, firearms have been an important element of American identity since the beginning of our history, even as we continue to argue passionately about the extent to which their possession, sale, and use should be regulated. But after a thorough exploration of the issues Americans disagree over, he believes there are roads beyond the stalemate over guns that might spare innocent lives without sacrificing the right to bear arms. Craig R. Whitney is retired from the New York Times, where he served over the years as a reporter, a foreign correspondent, and an editor. His new book is called Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment. Craig, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
We should say you describe yourself as a conservative liberal. Just to get that out of the way, what does that mean to you?
Well, I'm not out on the far left, mm-hmm. and as far as gun control goes, I'm not afraid of guns, and I don't think that keeping as many people as possible from buying guns is necessarily the right way to control gun violence.
Now, you mentioned that you used guns when you were in the service, but you don't consider yourself an expert, or did not before you undertook this project. What got you interested in exploring this issue?
Well, I served in Vietnam in the Navy during the war, and I was a correspondent there for 2 years for the Times, so I saw a lot of guns there and carried a .45 around in Saigon for the year that I was there in the Navy. But getting out of the Navy, I went back to the Times, and I worked as a foreign correspondent in Europe, and I was in Moscow and Germany and France and England. And all those years that I was abroad, periodically we would have some catastrophic gun violence, massacre, shooting, and I would read about these, and my friends would say, what's going on in America? Why are you Americans so in love with guns when horrible things like this happen? And then I'd see that, nothing really would happen. We would say, well, it's terrible, something like the Columbine shooting or the more recent ones we've had. And just like then, now we have these massacres like in Aurora and in the movie theater. And we deplore the deaths and say it's time to think about the families, and then we don't do anything. And I think the reason for that is that we're kind of paralyzed. So I thought while I was abroad, when I get chance, when I have time, I'd like to find out why do we have the right to keep and bear arms, and how come it's in the Bill of Rights, and is it consistent with reasonable gun control or not? And that kept me busy for 3 years after I retired.
Why did the Founding Fathers feel it was necessary to spell out the right to gun ownership in the Bill of Rights?
Well, it was a purely political thing, really. When the Constitution was written and then put to the states for ratification, it quickly became apparent to the founders that they might not get the ratification of the 9 states that were required to put it into effect without promising some changes to it after they ratified it. So they did. They proposed a Bill of Rights, and in the Bill of Rights, of course, is the Second Amendment, which recognizes the right to keep and bear arms. And the reason it recognizes it is it was thought that the states, which had their own militia forces, could resist an attempt by some tyrannical leader of the federal government who might take it into his head to create a standing army and then roll over the state's militias and take over. They could resist that kind of potential tyranny if their militias' existence was protected, and that's what the Second Amendment was designed to guarantee.
And the right to gun ownership, in some ways, based on what you just described, was tied up in one's responsibility to the community, to the people who lived near you.
Right. The thing is that in the colonies, right from the start, from Jamestown and even Massachusetts on, every grown adult white male, at least, was entitled, this was recognized in common law, in British common law and later American common law, to have and use guns for self-protection and for hunting and so on, and defense against Indian attacks. And that right is what the Second Amendment recognizes. It didn't create a new right to keep and bear arms. It just recognized this right, which had always existed and was taken for granted.
You know, it's interesting, too, that to some modern ears, it sounds preposterous to think that the federal government could sort of storm into a territory and try to take over in a tyrannical way. But we have to remind ourselves of the times that people were living in, of what they had just endured with dealing with a tyrannical government. It didn't seem so crazy to them at that point.
That's right. And as you recall, when the Constitution replaced a looser system, mm-hmm. The Confederation, precisely because the separate colonies and states feared too much control, too much power in the hands of a federal government could lead to the same kind of oppression they had just suffered at the hands of the British. And that was what they were trying to prevent in the Articles of Confederation. They didn't work out so well as a way of running the country. So they drafted a new constitution, which is full of checks and balances precisely to keep the federal government's powers within limits. But they wanted even more of them and put those in the Bill of Rights, which was ratified 3 years after the Constitution was.
If, as you say, it is time for liberals to sort of get over it and accept that the right to bear arms is an individual right granted to us as individuals, talk a bit about the case law that has affirmed that view.
Well, for a long time, the Supreme Court didn't say much of anything about the Second Amendment. When it did speak out about, what exactly did the Second Amendment guarantee, it seemed to say, it's a prohibition against action by Congress. As the 19th century wore on, the right to keep and bear arms turned into had a focus on self-defense, which it didn't really have in the late 18th century when the Second Amendment was adopted. And then finally, in 1939, the Supreme Court ruled in United States versus Miller, which was a case about somebody who had challenged the 1934 National Firearms Act, which made it impossible for ordinary people to have machine guns and, heavy weapons like that. This was passed because of what had happened during Prohibition and after, the growing problem of organized crime. But the Supreme Court said in that U.S. versus Miller case something that was taken for years afterwards to mean that you didn't have the right to keep and bear arms unless you had some sort of connection to a militia, because there is that connection between the militia and the right to bear arms in the language of the Second Amendment. So right up until 2008, it wasn't that clear in a lot of court cases whether ordinary people had an individual right or whether you had to have some sort of, military association to really be entitled to the right to keep and bear arms. And what the Supreme Court did in 2008 in District of Columbia versus Heller was rule that the district's ban on handguns, you couldn't have a handgun in the District of Columbia, it just wasn't allowed, or you couldn't get a license for one. They ruled that that was a violation of the individual right to keep and bear arms that was protected by the Second Amendment. So since 2008, that has been recognized as the law. And what I found when I did my historical research was that I didn't agree entirely with the way the Supreme Court came to this ruling, but I think their conclusion was right. If you go back into history and look at what happened in the colonial days and in the Revolutionary period and then after, that right was a common law right which everybody had, or at least all white males until later in our history. You didn't have to be in the militia to have the right to have a gun. If you had a gun, you had a duty to serve in a militia if you were called. So there was that connection between civic duty and the right to keep and bear arms. And I think today there's still a relationship between a responsibility to use firearms safely and see that their use doesn't endanger the general population. I think that civic duty, if you will, still exists, and it isn't recognized by most of the groups like the NRA that support gun rights.
Craig, do you happen to have in front of you, or do you have memorized the text of the Second Amendment?
I happen to have it right in front of me, and the language is, you know, often taken. People often say it's convoluted and hard to understand, but I think it's pretty clear. It says, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, it doesn't say there shall be, the people shall have the right to keep and bear arms. It assumes this right is already there, which it was. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed because a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state. Doesn't mean you can't keep and bear arms if you don't belong to a militia. It simply says you couldn't have militias if the people who would be called up to serve in a militia didn't have arms, and they have that right under common law.
So let's get down to brass tacks here. 300 million guns in the country right now, and that's an estimate, but you're not the only person that has put the number at about that figure. We're too far down the road, even if every American decided it wouldn't be a bad thing to limit or even restrict the right to gun ownership. We're never going to get rid of them. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, realistically, how could you? Now, interestingly enough, in 1969, after a wave of violence in the 60s and turbulence, there was a commission that had been set up under the Johnson administration to examine the causes and possible solutions to the problem of gun violence. And that commission was headed by Milton Eisenhower, who was Dwight Eisenhower's brother. It recommended in 1969 that the United States government outlaw and seize what they estimated at the time were 29 million handguns across the country. They thought that was the way, that was what you had to do if you wanted to stop the gun violence, gun crime problem. Well, needless to say, you know, by that time the Nixon administration was coming into power and that recommendation went nowhere. But I think that memory of it set off fears among people who do value the right to have and keep guns, that the organizations that support them still play on today. The NRA is all the time warning its members that, you know, if Obama's reelected, then he'll seize all our guns. There's never been even a hint that Obama would do that if he was reelected, and before he was in the debate, he, as he had done before, said he supported the Second Amendment as an individual right to keep and use firearms. But you couldn't, how could you seize 300 million guns? Not all of them are handguns. You know, probably, I don't know, 80 million of those 300 million guns are handguns. But there's no way the U.S. government can or will or would seize 80 million guns. So our problem is, how do we keep people who shouldn't have guns from getting them? It's not, you know, how do we get rid of 80 million guns? It's how do we keep the people who obviously shouldn't have guns, people who are mentally unstable or criminals, for instance, how do you keep them from getting a hold of guns? That's what reasonable gun control laws should try to do.
And we will discuss that after the break. My guest is Craig R. Whitney, author of Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Craig R. Whitney. He is a retired reporter, foreign correspondent, and editor for the New York Times, and he's also author of the new book Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment. If you would like to weigh in on any of this or ask a question, you can do so at any time. 1-800-933-5372 is the telephone number. You can send email to think at kera.org. Gun control advocates, Craig, are quick to point out that the Second Amendment was written at a time when firearms technology was a world away from what it is today. Does that matter with regard to the intent of the Constitution?
Well, the Supreme Court ruled in 1939 that it did when it said you can't have machine guns and weapons that were not in common use at the time of that the Second Amendment was put into writing and put into effect and ratified. So technology does make a difference. You can't go out and buy, or almost nobody can go out and buy a fully automatic gun like the AK-47 or the M16 used by our military. You can buy guns that look like those and are designed on designs like those, but they're not fully automatic. They're only semi-automatic. You have to squeeze the trigger each time to fire. Now, gun control advocates argue after the guns like that were used in massacres like the one in the movie theater and in others, that these are weapons based on designs for soldiers to use, enabling them to kill as many people as possible. Why do we have guns like this in the hands of civilians in the United States? As I say, there's a difference between fully automatic and semi-automatic weapons. Lots of people use these guns for sport at shooting ranges. I think they're probably less useful for self-defense in the home than many people who argue that they'd be good for that really realize. You know, they're big, they're bulky, it's hard to store them safely. And a lot of gun owners are much more conscious of the need for safety than their critics give them credit for being.
Yeah, let's talk about this term gun nut, which I find, regardless of where you are on these issues, is sort of supremely unhelpful, because it automatically sets up not just a dichotomy between people who advocate for greater gun rights and people who advocate for greater control, but it sort of it automatically assumes them to be enemies on all counts.
That's right. And I think liberals would do well, liberals and people who are concerned about gun violence and think stronger gun control is what we need to keep it in check. They do well, I think, to take away from the gun rights lobbies and advocates, who sometimes take extreme positions, take away from them the argument that we liberals don't recognize that it is an individual right. If liberals would make it clear that they do agree, they do accept that, because history teaches us that. Obama has said that in one of the debates before the election. Then that would make it harder for extremists who favor gun ownership to convince their members that gun ownership is constantly under threat, because liberals want to take your guns away from you. And liberals have to recognize as well that gun control alone is never going to control gun violence. Here in New York City, we have very strict gun control. If I thought I needed a pistol because somebody had threatened me, I couldn't get a license to have one. Even in my apartment, the police just don't give them out. But how does keeping me from buying a gun really affect the problem of gun violence? We have shootouts every weekend in the summer in New York City. These are shootouts by people who have illegal guns, who don't pay attention to what the law requires. They don't get licenses for their guns, but they can still get hold of them. So gun control alone is not the answer. You've got to affect the way people behave. I think the NRA is right in one respect when it says that guns don't kill people. People do.
You caution against writing gun laws that end up being too broad to hold up in court or to be enforceable. What parameters do you think lawmakers should apply when crafting legislation?
Well, it takes a lot of hard work, and it takes talking with the people on the other side. I think one of the things that Mitt Romney said he did when he was governor of Massachusetts was he was able to get people who wanted stronger gun control laws to talk with people who favored who wanted to guarantee the right of gun ownership to talk with each other. In my book, I suggest that if you want to design acceptable gun laws, you got to talk with the NRA about it. If the NRA would be reasonable and agree to talk, who knows more about guns, actually, than the NRA does? But to start that kind of discussion is one of the aims I had in writing the book. And I'm, you know, not naive. I don't think this is going to change overnight, and there's a lot of mistrust to overcome.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now on the phone to Kyle in Wichita Falls. Hello, Kyle.
Hi. Was curious. I'm a liberal and also in the Texas Army National Guard, and I love guns. And I often hear from my peers, it's a Brady Group going after gun control. Is there ever been any thought that maybe the gun industry, such as Hornaday, Winchester, Colt, would actually be supporting gun control legislation to limit stuff to actually boost their sales? I look at like the 1968 Gun Control Act or 922 R regulations as far as foreign parts in a rifle. And that to me seems evidence of propping up industries that allows American industries to benefit from gun control legislation. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, there are people on the gun rights side. The National Shooting Sports Federation, for instance, doesn't take the same confrontational "they're out to get us" approach that the NRA does, and they have, of course, been effectively urging gun owners to follow ways of storing and keeping guns that don't endanger other people, and they acknowledge that using a firearm responsibly is a duty.
What makes the NRA such a singularly powerful lobby?
Well, I think, as I say, they can play on the fear that many gun owners have that urban liberals, gun control advocates, are going to take your guns away. And there are lots of people in this country who don't live in cities on the coast who have guns for hunting and for various other purposes, including self-defense when they live in isolated areas. You know, I don't think gun laws should be the same for people who live in New York City and for people who live in Montana or Wyoming.
Or Texas, for that matter.
Or Texas, absolutely. You have a different history and a different setting, and gun regulations ought to reflect the needs and problems of the localities they apply to, not abstract notions that guns are bad or inherently dangerous.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Frankie on the line next in Fort Worth. Hello, Frankie.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
I just wanted to say that I am a licensed gun owner. I oppose guns for hunting, but I like my guns for home protection. And I think the answer is that we should have more education about guns. That should be, I don't know, about the gun companies or something like that, to be sure when they sell one that education is of great importance. Maybe the liberals would leave us alone.
What do you think about that, Craig?
I couldn't agree with that more. There are some states that do require that you demonstrate, you know, the way you do when you get a driver's license. You have to show somebody who's giving you the driver's license that you know how to drive safely. Why shouldn't everybody who has a gun be required to pass some kind of examination that shows they know how to use it safely, how to store it safely, you know, when to use it? Some states require this, others don't. I think it's dangerous to just assume that because we have the right to keep and bear arms, you don't need to show any kind of expertise in using them. You don't have to be an expert, but you should know how to use a gun safely and when the law allows you to use it in self-defense and when it when it's wiser not to use it. All that should be part of instruction that's required, I think, before you get a gun license. But that shouldn't be devised by the federal government. It should be local jurisdictions that do that. I assume that's the case in many places.
While you're supportive of the individual right to bear arms, you do have concerns about things like stand your ground laws, which we have in Texas and which exist in, I think, 29 other states. Talk about your concern about those.
Well, my concern is that, first of all, how often was it before they passed stand your ground laws in various places that somebody who used a gun in self-defense was convicted of aggression or assault for doing that? I don't think it's that often. And passing a law like a stand your ground law that makes it easier, basically, for somebody to shoot to kill, that can be taken advantage of by criminals as well as people who are legitimately trying to defend themselves. And I don't think state legislators recognize that. I just think it's a bad idea in general to pass a law that makes it easier to kill.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. John's on the line next in Farmers Branch. Hello, John.
Hi, how are you doing? I just had a question about if we, like, I'm from the Midwest, and everybody pretty much knows how to shoot maybe by age 8, age 10. And if we could just put it into the schools as part of PE with that training, like, teach people further respect so when they went to get a license as an adult, they had a better understanding.
Well, when I was in school in central Massachusetts, it wasn't part of the school curriculum. This was, by the way, a long time ago in the 1950s. But many of my classmates in the small town I grew up with in 30 miles west of Boston belonged to the Rod and Gun Club, and they went out and practiced at shooting ranges. They did get exactly the kind of training you're talking about. My son, even in a summer camp in Maine in the 80s, got a certificate from an NRA instructor who was teaching the kids how to about using firearms safely and practicing shooting at a range. So, sure, I think it wouldn't be harmful, and there are schools in some places that do have classes for this, and especially where there are lots of guns and people have them commonly, that should be part of your education.
Okay, we should talk about something that virtually everyone in this country agrees on, and first of all, we should stand up and cheer that there is anything that still exists, but I think most Americans agree it's reasonable to limit access to guns for people who have criminal records, particularly violent criminal records, and people who have been demonstrated to be suffering from mental illness. How good are the kind of background checks we have at this point in the United States at catching these people before they are able to purchase a weapon?
Not as good as they ought to be. In fact, sometimes pretty terrible. I discovered that a lot of states, at least right through the first part of the decade of this century, weren't reporting to the federal database the names of mentally unstable people or people who had been adjudicated as mentally unstable. In fact, New York State was one of them. It had reported, I think as of 2007, all of five names. Well, I know myself more than five people in New York City who are who are probably, you know, shouldn't have guns for mental reasons. So that's ridiculous. And there have been various attempts made to tighten this up and to make states comply with the requirement. And I think, you know, especially the cases we've seen of the shooting of Congresswoman Giffords in Arizona, and the massacre in the movie theater at Halloween. Earlier.
The Batman movie over the summer.
That's why I'm thinking.
Yeah, he was in costume. Mm-hmm.
That they show that, you know, those people would not have been able to buy guns if their mental instability had been caught and reported to the background check system. And, you know, how you tighten those up, you'll never be able to eliminate the risk absolutely. And, you know, people do go off the deep end sometimes, and they don't always do their violence with guns. Guns aren't the only way to do it. But you could certainly lessen the number of incidents like those that we've had if we tightened up the system that requires states to report to the background system, which is administered by the FBI. Then at least you couldn't go out and buy a gun and a huge 100-round magazine for one without any further ado the way the Batman guy did it.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Michael on the line in Euless. Hello, Michael.
Hey, how you doing? Love your show. So my sister was actually in the fourth row of that theater, and she died there.
Oh.
And I haven't really been paying too much attention to see if any legislation has been passed to restrict the amount of ammunition or gear you can buy online. But I know for sure that you can't do something like that with a knife. There's no way you could make that happen. So while I'm sitting here angry and frustrated that nothing is being done to limit that sort of random violence, and I know it's pretty much impossible, but shouldn't we be trying to do something? I mean, right after that, you had the Sikh shooting and other things, and it's just extremely frustrating for me, and I don't really know what I could do to help the situation.
Michael, I'm so sorry for your loss. We'll get a comment from Craig about that after this break. We are speaking this hour with Craig R. Whitney. He is retired from the New York Times, and he's the author of the new book, Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Craig Whitney. He has worked as a reporter, foreign correspondent, and editor for the New York Times. He's now retired from the paper and has just written a book called Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. And Craig, you'll recall, that's where we heard from Michael before the break. He told us his sister was killed in the Aurora Theater attack. He's angry. He's frustrated. Are there laws on the horizon that are sort of reasonable to the extent that they might actually be followed without restricting the access of people who have the right to bear arms in this country?
Right now, no. And I think Michael has every right to be angry, and I sympathize with him, and I'm sorry for his loss. But President Obama did say in the last debate before the election that there could be a move to reinstate the ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. Now, it will fail unless it is formulated and talked through with the people who value the right to have weapons like that for sporting purposes. I thought after the Aurora massacre that perhaps one way to do this, to lessen the possibility that weapons like that can be used the way the gunman did in Aurora, would be to require that if you're going to buy a large amount of ammunition or a large high-capacity magazine for a semi-automatic assault weapon like that, that you had to could only do it if it was in connection with membership in a gun club or a shooting range club. And, you know, maybe that's one way to do it. I don't know. I think the gun rights lobby, for want of a better word, will oppose any attempt to reinstate the ban the way it was. But there has to be a discussion. It took Ronald Reagan, when he was president, 10 years after the attempted assassination that nearly killed him and made a partial invalid of his press secretary, James Brady. It took President Reagan 10 years to come around to it, but he finally did support the Brady Bill in an article in the New York Times that Reagan wrote in 1991. And its main provision that he supported was to impose a waiting period. You had to wait 15 days before you bought a handgun. That later changed and was replaced basically by the National Instant Check System, the background check system, which is still in effect. The assault weapons ban expired at the end of at the beginning of 2004, but the NICS is still in effect, and President Reagan supported it. It took him 10 years to come around to it. You have to have a long period of thoughtful discussion and back and forth, serious, between people who support gun control, people who oppose it, before you're ever going to come to a reasonable solution, the same as we are going to have about taxes and revenues and spending cuts. If we just take absolutist positions and butt heads, then nothing's going to happen. So I wish Michael all success in whatever he can do to encourage discussion like that. We should have it.
So talk about this, Craig. I mean, we are well aware that the criminal background check system is not perfect. Certainly people can, you know, purchase a gun for someone else who wouldn't have passed the check, but at least it's in place. On the other hand, there are gun shows, there are private individual-to-individual sales that in most cases are entirely unregulated and not subject to criminal background checks.
That's right, and I'm glad you mentioned that because that's very important. It's not just gun shows. At gun shows that you can have private sales that don't have to go through the background check system. It's any kind of private sales over the Internet, over the telephone. And that may be 40% or so of all gun sales in this country. I think there's absolutely no excuse for that, and we should move as quickly as we can to make it mandatory for all gun sales to buyers have to be cleared by the National Instant Check System.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Dave on the line now in Fairview. Hello, Dave.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
This is an interesting discussion, and I just had a couple of comments I wanted to make that just occurred to me as I was listening. One was in regards to the NRA and their very strong stance about people trying to take away other people's guns. And I'm thinking back through history, back in the First and the Second World Wars, when our veterans were allowed to bring back war souvenirs, which were the weapons that they picked up from the battlefields. And I'm not aware of a lot of gun restricting legislation back in those days. But from those days to present, overwhelmingly, the legislation has been to limit gun use. And it hasn't been a pendulum that swings towards limitation on one end and then back towards gun ownership freedoms on the other end. It's been a constant swing in one direction.
What do you think about that, Craig? Has it been more limitation only?
No, certainly not. Assault weapons ban expired in 2004. So, you know, there was a move to control it, and then it was allowed to expire, and it's not in effect now. So it's not been a one-way street altogether.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Email address is think@kera.org. We have an email here from Don, who writes, "As an Obama-voting white wine and cheese liberal who also likes guns and hunting, I tip my camo cap to Mr. Whitney. While I may disagree with some of his specific positions, he is positing an alternative theory that is badly needed. Today, we're caught between warring philosophies and policies emanating from the gun control lobby and the NRA. I'm more familiar with the NRA, and I'm embarrassed by its fear-mongering and demagoguery. I have no room for absolutism. Is that the problem, that Craig, that neither side is willing to look at compromise?
Yeah, probably, you know, on the gun control side, there may be a little more willingness to do this than there is on the NRA side. But like him, I'm an NRA member, and I was just surprised at first, and then later I cynically disabused by the constant reminders the NRA would send me and all other members that we should get out and vote and make sure Obama was defeated at the in the November elections, because he was going to otherwise take not only the freedom to own and use guns, but all our freedoms away. Well, to me, this is, you know, crazy. That's not American-style politics the way I grew up with it in the 50s as a Republican at the time in my family in Massachusetts.
Why do you think this issue has gotten wrapped up in the culture wars? I mean, Texas may be unusual in that you do meet lots of liberals who happen to also have grown up using guns and continue to do so. Certainly, there must be states where people are, where there are conservatives who have no interest in owning a gun. Can you talk about why we now kind of shorthand this issue into right and left?
Well, I think some of it is along the same lines as urban-rural parts of the country. You know, by and large, people who live in big cities where there are lots of illegal guns and shootings have a different attitude about gun control than people who live out in Texas or in other parts of the country where these are not such big problems. And I think that congruence kind of explains a lot of why people take these different attitudes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. David is on the line next in Dallas. Hi, David.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Okay. Two comments. One, there are thousands of felons who are nonviolent, federal felons especially, that once you're a fellow federal felon, I don't care if it's 50 years and you cheated on your income tax, you cannot own a firearm. The United States government, the FBI, and the ATF do everything they can to keep you from having a gun forever, which I think is erroneous, it's wrong, because even if you've committed this felony, which is a nonviolent crime, you still have a right to protect yourself and your family. Number two, I heard the young man that said that he had his sister killed in
Aurora, yeah.
Yeah, in Aurora. And one, if there was a person there or two that was actually concealed carry, that guy would have been most likely killed. Now, I've heard someone on your show or another show that said, well, you wouldn't be able to hit him. Then you don't know how to shoot. If you do, that's number one. But number two, if you wiped all the guns out of America right now, you would have murders committed by knives, clubs, and if you wiped all those out, then people would run people over with cars. You could do more damage, which most people don't realize this, with an ordinary hunting shotgun with an extension tube on it than a machine gun.
Well, you've put a lot on the table there, David, and I appreciate your comments, but let's give Craig a chance to respond to the several points that you've made.
Well, I don't agree with everything he said, but I do point out in the book that the worst gun massacre I know of happened in a country with very strict gun control laws, Norway, mm-hmm. last year. That no one has killed as many people as he did. I think it was 69 people, young people, shot by a single guy in Breivik, who's now in prison and probably will be for the rest of his life. So, no, gun control doesn't solve all the problems. And you're right, if you don't have guns, you use other things to commit crimes. But the prevalence of guns in our country makes our murder rate much higher than it is in any European country where they have stricter gun control laws. It's unrealistic, yes, to expect that getting rid of all the guns would solve all the violent crimes that we have. But doing nothing just ensures that these things can keep happening as they have been doing and will continue to do unless we start talking seriously about how can we control and lessen gun violence.
What about David's point, Craig, that it's unfair to restrict gun ownership for a lifetime by non-violent felons?
Well, when you commit a felony, you risk losing a lot of rights, including the right to own a gun and the right to vote in many places. Now, there have been some cases, though, where felons who have come under threat to their lives have gone to court and gotten their gun rights restored. It's not impossible. It's very difficult. But, you know, my sympathies, frankly, don't extend very far to felons. Anybody who gets a sentence for a felony, basically, you know, tough luck.
Do you imagine, it's funny that you've mentioned Europe, and that's been my experience as well. When you go to Europe, if they know one thing about the United States, it's that we love our guns in this country. Do you imagine any change in society could in the future sort of decrease the American, love affair may be the wrong word, but the American affinity for firearms and gun rights?
I think it's so deeply ingrained in our in our history and in our mentality. You know, Americans like to think they're self-sufficient and independent, and they don't like to be totally dependent on anybody else for things like their livelihoods or their personal safety. That's at least the attitude they have. And I think, though, that if people would look at facts, when the NRA talks about how you got to have guns to protect yourself because criminals have them and they'll come and get you if you leave yourself defenseless. Well, look, wait a minute. Violent crime, the rate of violent crime has gone down in this country in most places substantially over the last 10 or 15, 20 years because that was when the crack epidemic of the 70s and 80s began to ebb. And the NRA is still going around fear-mongering about that. That's one of the reasons why people still go buy guns who maybe don't need to use them. And in my experience, if you don't know how you use a gun properly, harking back to, you know, if people had been armed in the movie theater, then the guy couldn't have killed as many people as he did. That's assuming everybody's ready to use the gun when the surprise starts happening in the movie theater in Aurora and can get a proper aim and hit the guy.
And there's nobody in the way.
Yeah, that's right. And that there's nobody in the way. You ask police if they favor that kind of thing, and they'll tell you no. You know, they come into a scene like that where they're, if they got there in time, would be trying to restore order and get the shooter. And they're faced with 20 or 30 people who are firing guns. That's not a situation that's going to lead to a happy solution necessarily. So, and people who imagine that having a gun at home would enable them to, shoot an attempted rapist or a robber, maybe don't realize just how well they need to know how to use a gun.
Got to jump in here. We're out of time. Craig R. Whitney's new book is called Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment. Craig, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can send comments, questions, or suggestions for the show to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.